D-Mace, Finnegan, and Donick, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. And we are presented by Bet365. Whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, David James here with you. Derek Mason out today. He'll be back tomorrow, joining Jake Lyman on Stillman & Company as Jared takes yet another vacation before Titans training camp, which starts a week from yesterday. That's at least when Titans rookies and veterans report. So an article on CBSSports.com, the most important non-quarterback for each team in the NFL. Who is the most important non-quarterback for the Tennessee Titans this season, in your opinion? 615-737-1025. The author of this story, whose name is Jared Dubin, who David James points out, bears a striking resemblance to Big Joe Dubin. I don't know if Big Joe has a long-lost son named Jared. I guess we'll ask him.
We'll find out.
Hopefully. We'll find out.
I'm sure that is being speculated throughout Atlanta right now at the SEC Media Days at the College Football Hall of Fame. Hey, Jared Dubin? Who is this? Is he related to Big Joe?
By the way, our SEC Media Days coverage is sponsored by Brewhouse South. Experience Nashville's ultimate sports and brew hangout at Brewhouse South and Cool Springs. So I do want to focus on Dan Moore, because the author of the story mentioned that last season, Caleb Williams, in his rookie season with the Chicago Bears, was running for his life quite a bit. Now, even Caleb Williams acknowledged that some of the 68 sacks, that he took were on him. But this stood out to me, Willie. So Caleb Williams, his average time to throw last season was 2.92 seconds. Again, 2.92 seconds, which ranked seventh in the NFL.
Seventh longest. Meaning he holds the ball.
Yes. 2.92 seconds. By comparison, Will Levis averaged 2.68 seconds to throw the ball.
Yes, and I think he came under a lot of criticism because he held the ball too long. A lot of the sacks, I think we ended up having the debate. The offensive line was bad, but Will Levis did hold the ball. You put those two together, you got a lot of sacks.
So keep these numbers in mind. Caleb Williams, the average time to throw last season, when he took, again, 68 sacks.
Right.
2.92 seconds. Will Levis last season, who took 41 sacks in 12 games, 2.68 seconds. According to ESPN, Cam Ward's average time to throw at Miami, 2.91 seconds. So virtually identical to Caleb Williams last season. I found that to be interesting when having the conversation about the offensive line and the protection and the importance of Dan Moore, that Cam Ward, his average time to throw was basically the same average time to throw of Caleb Williams.
But one is at the college level, and one is at the pro level.
Yes.
So we have to make sure everybody understands that. This is radio, right? We're not putting a big chart in front of you. Because the college, it just illustrates how different the college game is. I would be curious what Williams was at USC, if it was close to that. Because in college, I think it's much easier for a quarterback who can move, like Williams and like Ward, to extend plays. And you want them to hold the ball more. And it's going to lead to good things because you can elude the rush. In the NFL, it's, as Williams found out, it's a lot more difficult. There were some plays that Williams made that were pretty spectacular, of him running around, extending plays, and then throwing it. That's going to change that average.
It wasn't super
efficient for Williams, though.
It appears that that number for Caleb Williams in his final season at USC was 3.21 seconds.
Interesting. So I don't know if that meant that he was scrambling a lot, extending plays that way, or his line was that good that they could hold the ball. It could be a number of different things. But by and large, I think what we want to see from Ward is, can he be better than Levis at getting the ball out quick? And as D-Mace has pointed out a lot, DeAndre Hopkins and the way they had the offense, it sort of slowed down the offense. I think Brian Callahan, if you look at the way he way they did it in Cincinnati for all those years, he would prefer an offense, for a number of different reasons, to get the ball out quicker. And so can they get a quicker offense? Can they get a better tempo to the offense where it's more rhythmic and you're not putting your quarterback in a position? Now, how do you do that? Number one, you got to stay out of the long situations, you know, second and nine, third and eight, because then you have to call the deep drops, and that's where Will Levis was a sitting duck, right? He was going to hold too much, and you had the disastrous right tackle situation and a rookie left tackle, and we know what the results were, right? So this goes back to, can Dan Moore give you steady play? He doesn't have to be great, but can he be a good left tackle, and can Latham be an enormous upgrade from Nicholas Petit-Frere, John Ojukwu, Leroy Watson, and whoever else you want to name who got a turn playing right tackle? Because it screwed up the whole offense. So I think that number, the 2 point whatever it is something that we should watch throughout the year.
By the way, according to Fantasy Points Data, which was retweeted into my timeline, the best pressure to sack ratios since 2021. Dead last at 120th, Will Levis in 2024, 32.3%. So 32.3% of his pressures turned into sacks.
So what was Williams?
They don't have that number.
Yeah. Well, Williams is probably not far behind, but it just shows you that that's the stat, is the percentage of dropbacks that you end up getting sacked.
Well, I can do that quick math if you give me a minute. I can do that quick math for you. It's not readily available. But this was interesting. This was a story written before the draft about Cam Ward and Shedeur Sanders holding the ball. And Craig Johnson, a longtime NFL assistant and quarterbacks coach for over two decades, was quoted as saying, "When a quarterback comes into the league, he simply thinks, I am faster, more athletic, or elusive than the people chasing me. But you have to learn quickly that being late anywhere in the NFL is where the trouble starts. You want creators with off-schedule ability, but the clock runs out for everybody." Now, Cam Ward is also quoted in this story. So I think this was Jeff Legwald wrote this story.
Yeah, former member of the Tennessee and alumni, just like yourself.
Yes. Ward's play style resulted in an FBS leading 39 touchdown passes last season, and the fiery competitiveness that took him from a zero-star recruit at FCS school Incarnate Word in 2020 to fourth in the Heisman voting at Miami in 2024 shows when he's asked whether he waits too long to throw. At the end of the day, if you have time in the pocket, why would I not hold the ball and let my receivers get open, Ward said. If you ever make plays out of structure, of course you're going to hold the ball and try to make a play and get your receivers open.
And I think there are great quarterbacks. I think of Ben Roethlisberger. I think Patrick Mahomes, right? He can hold it a little longer. There are times where that's good. But I still think over the course of the season, that number's got to get knocked down. It's just not going to be like it was in college. And that is going to be part of the growth process that every rookie that comes into the league, I don't care what offense you ran in college, but you've got to learn that. The ball has to get out.
By my quick math, Caleb Williams' sack-to-pressure ratio was 26.2%. He was sacked 68 times on 260 pressures, so more than a quarter.
Yeah, I'm looking at Pro Football Reference. They have a stat called sack percentage, just the number of sacks that you took compared to the number of dropbacks you had. So Deshaun Watson had the worst in only 7 starts, so he barely qualified. 13.2% he was sacked on dropbacks. Will Levis was 11.99, second worst, and Caleb Williams right behind him at 10.79. So I think Williams and Levis are a good benchmark for Ward, as kind of like that's the floor. Like Ward has got to be above that floor just to get the discussion started. There's going to be times he struggles. I think we all know that. But it's his ability and also the offensive line's improvement. Those two things will be a big, big thing to watch to see what that number ends up being. 2.x. If he can get it closer to 2.5, that would be a big victory. I think that would mean good things.
I'm looking at the leaders in time to throw last season. Lamar Jackson, number one on the list, 3.14 seconds. That's no surprise because he is quite elusive. Right behind him, Jalen Hurts at 3.13. Sam Darnold at 3.08. They were the only qualified quarterbacks who averaged more than 3 seconds to throw the ball. C.J. Stroud, 2.97. Anthony Richardson, 2.95. Brock Purdy, 2.93. Caleb Williams, 2.92. And again, according to ESPN, Cam Ward...
Brock Purdy was that high. I'm surprised that Purdy would be up there that high.
According to ESPN, Cam Ward last season at Miami was at 2.91.
Okay.
Which would have put him tied with Justin Herbert and Bo Nix last season in the NFL.
Where was Mahomes?
Mahomes was 16th, tied for 15th, at 2.81, tied with Kyler Murray at 2.81.
Okay. That's interesting just to get a reference. I would have thought, because you always say, like, when you do the drills, when you go to training camp and they're doing 2.5, I think, is right around what you want, ideally, the ball to come out at. But things affect that number, right? The designed rollouts or times that you're just eluding the rush and extending the play the way you should. But a basic drop back, you know, you want to have a lot. You want to ask your line to protect for 2.5 seconds before the rush comes in there. I would bet that it wasn't so good. The Titans offensive line didn't grade very well.
No,
in that
did
area.
Not. The qualified quarterback out of 36 quarterbacks, qualified quarterbacks, with the shortest time to throw by on average was Tua at 2.42 seconds.
And you think about the offense of Miami, it's really predicated on the quick release, the quick reads, you know, those slants that they hit you with.
Mm-hmm. As this quarterbacks coach, Craig Johnson, was quoted in this story from Jeff Legwalt, the toughest lesson is really that as a quarterback, you have to earn the right to hold the ball a little longer. You want guys who make some plays off schedule, not guys who are just always off schedule, and that is the lesson.
That's the point.
And you play a long time.
That is a really good synopsis of that, of what you're looking for.
In terms of the most important non-quarterback, Joey from Gallatin on our text line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, says, for me, it has to be Jeffrey Simmons to be a better leader on the defense and to improve on his game from last year. If he can improve and leave everything outside of the field alone, it will help a lot.
I can't wait to see how this goes in. There's a lot of levels to it, and I think we have to try to keep the context of they don't have Michael Irvin, et cetera, out on the outside, right? They don't have this great gifted wide receiver core, but I think the structure of the offensive line, getting the ball out, and maybe hopefully a steady running game to go with it, do you have a foundation of a good offense that you could build off of?
Wes in Clarksville says, has anyone went and looked at all of Levis's sacks and seen if it was more the offensive line's fault, or did he just not get rid of the ball? Wes, I am not a masochist. I am not going to go back and watch all of Will Levis's sacks from last season. I don't want to relive that. I'm sure somebody has done that. You're asking the wrong guy.
Well, Jared does have the film room.
Jared's
right?
Film room when he's not on vacation.
Okay. Does he go into the film room during vacation? Is that possible?
Jared definitely is the... I get the vibe that Jared is he still works while he's on vacation. He's just not on the air, but he's still doing work.
And he's very quick to tell you that you are not allowed to talk about any fun things you did on your vacation. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. I think that is an exercise, though, to Wes's question that I think they have spent a lot of time. If they weren't, I'm sure they were every week during the season, but since the season, when you're trying to break down what went wrong, I'm sure there was a ton of time devoted to that exact question, is what's on Levis, what's on the line, and how do we make it better? First by, you know, replacing Levis is but also the moves they made on the offensive line, I'm sure had to do with that. And we will have a question, because last year we asked the question, the 10 Titans questions, how many sacks will they give up this year? Can they get that number cut down significantly?
Wes says Jared would do the Will Levis
right.
film study.
Jared would do it. The question was, would his football eye be able to tell you? Because you can't always, we don't know what the name of the play was,
right,
what the design of the play was, and sometimes it may look like a guy blew an assignment, but you might learn something. There may be something you don't know about that. Jared assumes he knows all about every play that's
called. Someone much smarter than me would need to do that exercise. For example,
right.
Like
we could take a shot at it, right?
I would like to go back and look at the 16 and a half sacks that Dan Moore allowed according to Next Gen Stats and be able to place blame on either Moore or one of the Steelers quarterbacks. I'm not sure I have a discerning enough eye to be able to do that.
But I think I found myself, and you probably did as well, at times watching the game last year and saying, now there's a sack, but that was Levis. That was Levis stepping up in a pocket. We talked a lot about, this is something we haven't covered in this segment, but we did talk about this element on the time it takes to throw. There were times I thought that Levis stepped up into pressure. There's a great characteristic that the really good quarterbacks have, the feel of the pocket, where it always seems like, oh, they're going to get him, but the really good quarterback slides up and gives himself that extra second. Like Dan Marino was so good at it. A lot of guys who weren't great mobile running quarterbacks sometimes are really good at sliding up in the pocket. Brady was really good at it. Levis was the opposite. So it's not even necessarily that he wanted to hold the ball. He was trying to step up and make a throw, but he didn't have a feel for the rush, where the rush was coming from. And so I thought he stepped into a lot of sacks.
615-737-1025. So, Wes, if you or anybody else out there derives pleasure from experiencing humiliation, you can go back and watch all Will Levis' sacks from last season and get back to me. But I am not a masochist, so I am not going to do that. 615-737-1025. I do want to focus on one specific member of the Titans offensive line, because this one specific member of the Titans offensive line does get a lot of heat. And I want to discuss him coming up next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025-1063 the game. D Mace, Vingan, and Donick, 1025-1063 the game. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan here. Talking Titans. I want to shift gears here, Willie, to a member of the Tennessee Titans offensive line who's a bit of a punching bag for a certain section of Titans fans.
Well, there's a long line of them.
There is. By the way, before we get to that, I just have to laugh at this. So Ian Safar sends a grid of the Robbie and Rex Road program. He sends it to us at the end of every show, just so that we know what Robbie and Joe talked about. I just have to laugh at this. 6 o'clock, show open, / update on Joe's gout. So is the first thing that Robbie and Joe do every morning, do we get an update on Joe's gout? Now, I'm usually up that early, and I listen to the beginning of the show. I turned it on around 6:05 today, so maybe I missed the gout update. I missed the gout update. But is this a thing, Joe and Robbie, that you're doing every day? We need a Joe gout update? How is that not sponsored, by the way?
Back in the day,
I don't know, man.
When I lived in the Eastern time zone, I would get up and get the scores from the West Coast, you know, that weren't not in the morning paper. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to go to Sports Center, you had to watch, I had to find out who won the late games. So this is very similar. People wake up in this town, they need to know the gout update at 6 a.m.
Do they, though?
Yes, of course. We need to know how his gout is.
Oh, boy. Well, there is a sponsorship opportunity for any medical service out there. Joe's Gout Update sponsored by you. It's a great opportunity. Yes. I'm trying to sell ads while we're on the air. I don't know if Ian has unveiled the Gout Man and Robbie theme song that I suggested recently.
Right.
Gout Man. Da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Gout Man.
Okay, so this is part of the sponsorship. Here is the Gout Man song. So that plays, and then you give the update. Have you ever heard the update of gout? Like, what would be an update?
Usually it's Robbie just going, hey, Joe, how's your gout? Oh, you know, it's fine. And that's it.
That's it?
We don't get
it. We need more.
It didn't flare up today.
I just thought it was funny. Show open / update on Joe's gout / SEC Media Day. So we have to get the gout update before we get to SEC Media Days. Okay. That sidebar is now over. I want to talk about Peter Skoronski, who is the aforementioned punching bag among many Titans fans. So, as we've discussed over the past week or so, Jeremy Fowler is rolling out all of his lists of the top players in every position, according to league executives, coaches, and scouts. And the other day, Fowler unveiled his list of the top 10 NFL interior offensive lineman, and Peter Skoronski got a shout-out in the honorable mention category. Woohoo! One NFL personnel director was quoted as saying this, "Thought he had an uneven start to his career, but he's improved and was playing well down the stretch last season, arrow pointing up." By the way, Kevin Zeitler, the new right guard, in the also receiving vote section. So good for you. You go, Kevin Zeitler. But the Skoronski thing is interesting to me. So I was reading a story on Pro Football Focus predicting the NFL's most improved player at every position. And lo and behold, at guard, Peter Skoronski. And Pro Football Focus writes this, quote, "Drafted as a tackle, Skoronski played the first two seasons of his NFL career at left guard, earning a 61.6 grade in 2023 and a 60.3 grade in 2024, allowing 9 sacks and 60 pressures in two seasons. Despite the below-average grade, Skoronski took real steps forward as a pass blocker in the second half of the season, demonstrating the excellent footwork and hand usage that saw him drafted in the top 15. His season-long 76.3 pass blocking grade was 7th at the position, but Skoronski dominated in the final 7 games of the season, allowing just 1 sack and 5 pressures, while earning a league-high 88.2 pass blocking grade." So that lines up with the anonymous NFL personnel director who said arrow pointing up. According to Pro Football Focus, the best pass blocking guard in the NFL over the final 7 games of the season. So things are looking up. There really is no way, Willie, unless Skoronski turns into an annual All-Pro, that he is going to live up to his draft slot as the number 11 overall pick as a guard.
That's a lost cause.
At the number 11 overall pick slot. But I'm wondering what Skoronski can develop into that will leave Titans fans satisfied. If Skoronski, as he apparently demonstrated over the final 7 games of last season, can be one of the best pass-blocking guards in the NFL, will Titans fans accept that, still knowing that he was drafted a little too high?
I'm looking at the FTN Football Almanac, which used to be called Football Outsiders, and it is noteworthy. It's got to be especially hard for any analytics site to drill down on an offensive lineman. Because as we talked about earlier in the hour, it's really looked upon as a group of 5. And so sometimes it's hard to tell who's responsible for what. But here's how I would put it. Skoronski on this team that is so devoid of foundational players, the direction his career is going is vital. If you are trying to build a roster, which they are so far from being, they got so many things that they need. Like they're staring at a big, big mountain trying to climb. So what do you have right now? Latham and Skoronski have to be part of this. Skoronski has to get the second contract. FTN Football Almanac. They have Skoronski's grades as the following. He took a step forward as a run blocker. Still inconsistent as pass protection. Now, it doesn't talk about first half, second half in the last 7 games. I do remember Brian Callahan saying he thought that Skoronski overall made a nice jump at the end of the season. But FTN is stopping short of saying this guy is becoming a really good guard. They're still coming into question as to whether he will get the fifth-year option, is their evaluation. That's a little ominous for me. We discussed a lot his rookie year getting sort of short-circuited because of the appendectomy he had right in the middle of the season. That was a really tough one to overcome. And then, of course, he's also been hamstrung by the fact that the offensive line around him has been really, less than stellar. So this is a big, big year for him. If he can make another jump, then I'm confident that he can be a part of the future. They just don't have anybody right now on the team that you're saying is a slam dunk for a second contract. So Latham and Skoronski are vital, vital to get to that point. So I'm encouraged by Skoronski. He's never going to beat the rap
of you use the 11th pick on a guard. That's
guard.
Good. And Jared will never let you if you listen to this station.
You
right?
can't just say guard. You have to say guard. Of course. Like you're of a, course. Like you're a pirate.
Right.
Guard.
But if he's a good, solid guard for a long, long time, that's something. And relative to the rest of the roster, he's way ahead of everybody. He's the least of your he's not been the guy that's getting crushed every Monday, thanks to Nicholas Petit-Frere. But I do think if they can fix the tackle spot and the line does start to get better and Skoronski is lagging behind and he doesn't earn that second contract, then you're really going to hear. He's really going to be a focal point of criticism because Rand Carthon, as he leaves, has got very few feathers in his cap. That's one that could go either way, Skoronski for me.
PFF continues, to your point, Willie, the Titans' commitment to improving the offensive line could help Skoronski's improvement in his third year, too. After all, the offensive line is an ecosystem where chemistry and cohesion matter significantly. The front office added Kevin Zeitler and Dan Moore to the offensive line, and both will be starters in 2025, providing veteran experience. Zeitler's 86.5 grade in 2024 was third among guards. Skoronski looks in prime position to fully break out in 2025, capturing his pass-blocking form from the back end of last season and hopefully benefiting from an improved unit.
That would be big. We hit that earlier. If Moore can solidify the left tackle and Latham makes the right tackle position from the biggest, maybe the biggest weakness in the sport to a, you know, what you hope, Latham, that's another guy. He's just as important as Skoronski. He's the 7th pick. So he's got to be a pillar, right? He's got to be a guy that you build around, even though it's right tackle. So if you're going right tackle, he needs to be a great right tackle. That will help. Those two things could help Skoronski if there's any semblance of that.
By the way, Kevin,
but we have to believe it when we see it.
Kevin Zeitler was one of the best pass protecting right guards according to Next Gen Stats. He had a pressure rate allowed of 5.1%, the 5th lowest among right guards. So you hope that Zeitler does for Latham what Moore can do for Skoronski. So that'll be something to monitor over the course of the season.
And then there's the question of how quickly Cushenberry
that is
in the middle.
That is a big if.
Can be out there, and when he does get out there, what does he look like coming off an Achilles injury?
That is a critical point. Michael and Madison on our text line says, Joe's gout saga is only rivaled by his Skiatika flummox. That is a classic moment on this station. Joey from Bellevue says, hey, listening.
Are we talking about sciatica?
You don't recall this? This was back in the Ryan Porth days.
Oh, I don't remember this.
When Porth was producing, I believe they were talking about Caleb Farley.
I think so.
And Joe did not recognize the word sciatica.
Oh, I see.
And pronounced it
sciatica.
Sciatica. David, maybe we can find that coming back from break or something. But yes, and Joey from Bellevue says, hey, listening to Robbie and Joe for several years, they are like family. That is true. So we care about how Joe's feeling. He has this rain cloud hovering over him that brings him bad luck between the gout and the deer. There's a lot going on with Joe Rexroth. So I get it. There does seem to be this dark cloud hovering over Joe Rexroth. But that's why we love Joe, because he keeps it optimistic most of the time. But again, if you're looking out there, if you are looking for a sponsorship opportunity, let me act as a salesman. Joe's daily gout update on Robbie and Rexroth is a perfect opportunity for you to sell your business. 615-737-1025 or phone and text lines are driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. I do want to take a quick hockey break here because I heard this on Robbie and Rexroth this morning, speaking of Robbie and Rexroth, about a specific player who's rumored to be available, who Robbie thinks could be a good fit for the Predators, and I don't disagree. And we will discuss that coming up next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025-1063, the game.
On Brugler, he actually has him fourth. He has him as a first, second round grade and number 30 overall. I mean, I think that's got to be largely about the injury. You're talking about a microdiscectomy.
Ugh.
By the way, I didn't even realize this. He also has had a torn ACL in the past. And sciatica symptoms from lifting weights that required a different surgery. So two surgeries plus an ACL.
What was that last word?
Sciatica. sciatica, and I may be totally butchering that, symptoms from lifting weights.
You probably are.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. It's sciatica. Oh, my God. I'm an idiot.
Oh, man. What a classic moment in the history of Robbie and
A writer.
That
still
is true.
Gets me every time.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, man.
When was this?
That was years ago. I believe they were talking about Caleb Farley. So when was he drafted? 2021?
Yes. So right around that time.
4 years. Four years ago by now. Oh, man. Oh, Joe. Mike on our text line says, the morning gout report brought to you by the Red Meat Council of Middle Tennessee.
Okay.
I don't know if there actually is a Red Meat Council of Middle Tennessee, but hey, if you're looking for some sponsorships, the gout segment apparently is very popular at the beginning of the Robbie and Rex Road program. And speaking of the Robbie and Rex Road program, I heard Robbie Stanley talk about this near the end of the program today. There is a young NHL player who is rumored to be available. His name is Mason McTavish. He is a center for the Anaheim Ducks. He's 22 years old. He turns 23 in January. He was the third overall pick of the Anaheim Ducks in the 2021 NHL draft. And Frank Saravalli, formerly of Daily Faceoff, a prominent NHL insider, had this report on McTavish the other day.
Any talk of Mason McTavish getting moved? He's one name to watch for me, I think, moving forward. I think it's been a tough go for McTavish in Anaheim. I view McTavish just from a, I don't know if mental standpoint, but body language standpoint is the right way to say it. I view him as sort of a bit of a depressed asset, in the sense that I think a really solid player that has been beaten down by a lot of losses in Anaheim, that I view him as similar to Trevor Zegras. I think a change of scenery would be good for him. I think there's a lot of teams that are interested. I think some teams have tried to work on what an offer sheet might look like for Mason McTavish, as it seems like that's one of those situations that's going to be a struggle, much in the same way that getting that Zegras contract was for Anaheim. But no one can really put together something on paper that they think is going to dissuade Anaheim from turning down or not matching that offer sheet. Just because the Ducks have so much cap space, it's really hard to offer sheet a team that has a ton of space. So keep an eye on Mason McTavish, though. I think he's going to be an interesting name to watch.
So that was Frank Saravalli talking about Mason McTavish. And Willie, we were just talking about this during the break. Barry Trotz will be the first to tell you that the Predator center depth this upcoming season, it's bleak. The way I see it right now, you have Ryan O'Reilly as your number one center, followed by Fedor Svechkov, followed by Eric Halla, followed by Michael McCarron. Now, Willie, you were out this day, but as we were discussing, Derek and I, that is, as we were discussing the post-free agency lineup for the Predators, I would have a hard time finding a center lineup on paper in the NHL that may be worse than the Predators, based on the one I just read. And we can have that argument at a different time. But
no, I think I agree.
Okay.
And for this reason, Colton Sissons, we know, was like the old security blanket.
Yes.
He wasn't going to light up the score sheet every night, but he was a good, solid pro that could fill a role at your 2, 3, or 4 center, and obviously he could play some wing. But without him, just the number of physical guys on the roster that can play center are limited. I don't think they got Eric Halla to be an everyday center. I think he is more in the role of assistants who could play center or wing. So right now, their depth chart would assume that Svechkov is an every night player in the league. And I think he's ready for that, but I'm not sure. Michael McCarron's in the last year of his contract. You don't want to play Steven Stamkos at center. Barry Trotz has said that on the record. So to make the decision to trade Sissons would tell you that of all of the things that they're going to try to accomplish between now and the start of the season, picking up another center in some form has got to be on the list. Would you agree? Just the way the roster is constructed. It's no NHL team would go into a year with that little depth at center, assuming that guys like David Edstrom, Brady Martin are not ready to help you yet. Now, Martin, could they give him a look for the first few games of the year, buy some time?
Mm-hmm.
yeah, that's plausible, but that's still a lot to ask. If your true goal is to see if you can bounce back, they need another center. Now, whether that's McTavish or Jack Roslovic, who's still out there, somebody like that, there's different ways they could go. But now that's the backdrop to me of the McTavish story.
So Shayna Goldman of The Athletic had a story the other day looking at McTavish as an offer sheet candidate. Now, if the Predators wanted to offer sheet McTavish and give him a cap hit of roughly $7 million, it would cost them a first-round pick, a second-round pick, and a third-round pick in 2026.
All those in 2026?
According to this screenshot, which I assume is from Puckpedia, it would be a 2026 first-round pick, a 2026 second-round pick, and a 2026 third-round pick to offer sheet Mason McTavish with a cap hit of at least roughly $7 million. Now, McTavish has been in the NHL now for parts of four seasons, three full seasons. He is coming off of a career-high 52-point season, 22 goals, 30 assists, and 76 games with the Anaheim Ducks. But Shayna Goldman makes an interesting point in this article, Willie, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, about the types of players I would like the Predators to take a shot on. She mentions Dylan Strome. Remember, Dylan Strome played for the Chicago Blackhawks. He was a restricted free agent, just like Mason McTavish. The Chicago Blackhawks did not give him a qualifying offer. He became an unrestricted free agent. The Capitals bought low, signed him to a cheap deal. Last season, he was their number one center, and I believe averaged a point per game. I believe he had 82 points in 82 games.
So they got a bargain.
Yes.
That has turned into a great asset, and that is a terrible decision that has haunted the Blackhawks. This is something completely different. This is a major investment.
Yes.
That you would have to do, but just to get McTavish.
I think Goldman's point was that any team rolling the dice on McTavish hopes that you have a Dylan Strome type return on investment.
Right.
A late bloomer who needs the right opportunity.
Right. But I think she leaves out the size of the investment, the gap between what they did when they got Strome as opposed to what it's going to take to get McTavish. It's apples and oranges. Now, how often have we discussed the Predators' need for players who are developed and in the range of those of the low to mid-20s that you could keep for a while? So this guy fits the bill, and he's a center. He was the third overall pick. So there's a couple of things, though, that come to mind. A, I can't give up my first-round pick for next year's draft if I'm Barry Trotz. No way. You agree? If the draft is what it's supposed to be next year, which is loaded, I need my first-round pick. Mason McTavish is not, to me, worth it to give up a first-round pick, I don't think, because here's my question. The Ducks, why do they want to get rid of Mason McTavish? They have cap space.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it.
What do they not see with him?
Well,
I mean,
they just sold low on Trevor Zegras, but they had been trying to move on from Zegras, I think, for a while.
Right. But I think he's a little further down the road.
Yes.
Zegras is a little older.
Yes.
His flaws. This guy's 22, and he's got a reasonable amount of production. Why wouldn't you want him to be the foundational guy? What's the holdup? They've got cap space? What?
Well, Saravalli, in his report, said that maybe McTavish has been beaten down by all of the losing that's been going on in Anaheim. I don't know if you watched the Predators this past season or not. But
right. Well, but that does happen to young players. And now the other thing, you sign him to a offer sheet of $7 million.
Yes.
Why would the Ducks not just match that game over?
Right.
It's over. Like they're not going to let him go for that.
So Caleb on our text line says we would have to give all of that up to acquire him. Is that how an offer sheet works? Yes. So if the Predators put together an offer sheet and let's say it's a 3-year deal with a cap hit of $7.1 million. There are certain thresholds based on the annual average value that if the team that you are offer sheeting chooses not to match, you have to give up that draft pick compensation. So if the Predators gave Mason McTavish a contract with a roughly $7 million cap hit, at least, if the Ducks said, nah, we're not interested, you can have him. The Predators would have to give up a first-round pick, a second-round pick, and a third-round pick next year. So yes, Caleb, that's how it works.
And I, in a normal situation, I don't think I would worry about that. That would be okay. But the first-round pick in next year's draft, knowing that the Predators are teetering, and that pick could be a top 10 pick next year if the season goes south, which it could. Is Mason Matavich that good and that much of a foundational piece that, A, the Ducks don't think so, if they're willing to let him go for a first, second, and third? They obviously don't think he's that good. They're not loaded. They have Leo Carlson, who is a special player, it looks like. So they have him. Do they not want Mason McTavish to be their number two center behind him for the long haul? And if so, why not? And if they don't, then is it worth giving up what could be a top 10 pick next year? It's a tough dilemma because there is a big, big, giant hole at center for the Predators, as we know.
615-737-1025, by the way. According to our fearless leader, Chase McCabe, Trey Wallace, the national college sports reporter for Outkick and Fox, will join us live from SEC Media Days in Atlanta at around 11:20. So looking forward to talking to Trey Wallace live from SEC Media Days in Atlanta. 615-737-1025. But before we get to Trey Wallace, some interesting comments about NIL from two completely different people. But I heard one, then I heard the other. I found it to be interesting. I want to play them both for you coming up next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025-1063. The game.